You're listening to the Saturday selection on Monocle 24, highlights from the weekend edition. Hello and welcome to the Saturday selection, the best of the weekend edition on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin. Well, during this show, we step into the world of Davian Nelson of the award-winning podcasts, The Kitchen Sisters.
We just believe in the deep value of gathering stories, gathering voices, hearing perspectives that are unknown, and there's a lot of power in storytelling.
I also caught up with a good friend of Monocle, Niven Govindan, to talk about his upcoming book.
In a nutshell, it's the story of an artist and her muse, and it's an American portrait painter. She's sort of early 80s, and she's working on what will probably be her final portrait.
And I spoke to author, zoologist, and publishing entrepreneur, Hector MacDonald.
So we look at the atrocities taking place in the Middle East, and people are rightly horrified by what IS has been doing in terms of crucifixions and beheadings and so on. But it's only 100 years ago that European powers were doing exactly the same thing.
All that over the next hour here on the Saturday Selection with me, Georgina Godwin. Davian Nelson. She's a screenwriter, a casting director. She's probably best known, however, as one half of the Kitchen Sisters. With Nikki Silver, the Kitchen Sisters are Peabody award-winning independent producers. They're non-profit production companies dedicated to creating public media and educational programmes that work to build community through storytelling. More specifically, they are the creators of hundreds of stories for public broadcast about the lives, histories, art and rituals of people who've shaped America's diverse cultural heritage.
Communal kitchen was a war zone. During the Stalin time, it was the most dangerous place to be in the kitchen.
Mafia kitchens from Sicily, dissident kitchens from Russia, turnspit dogs from medieval England.
Turnspit dogs, they were viewed as kitchen utensils, as piece of machinery.
They were referred to as the kitchen dog, the cooking dog, or the Wernerpeter cur.
Atomic wine from France.
I take the bottle in the hand, I put the bottle close to the detector, and we start to record the gamma rays we are looking for, radioactivity, in the wine.
From the Kitchen Sisters and PRX, Hidden Kitchens World, a new hour of kitchen stories that travel the globe. I'm your host, Frances McDormand.
My name is Gael Garcia Bernal. My grandmother used to cook the banana bread. It was like an Octavio Paz poem, complex and intense.
Back in a moment.
And back in a moment, here we are. Davia, thank you so much for coming in.
Such a pleasure to be here.
That's just a little tiny snippet of the thousands of hours of broadcasting that you've produced over the years, which spans many, many continents and, of course, has gone out on many, many different stations. It's quite difficult to sum up, actually, what the Kitchen Sisters are.
Possessed.
Radio goddesses, as we said earlier. But perhaps you could have a go. What would you call yourselves?
Well, we're radio producers and we're storytellers, and I think we make movies, but there aren't images, it's all sound. But we tell stories, you know, often from, we say, the flip side of history or the B side of history, voices that just usually don't make it to the radio, deeply layered, highly produced, this mix of interviews, oral history, music, archival audio, field recordings.
And where did it come from? Where did you start?
Oh, I just fell for radio as a girl. You know, growing up in Los Angeles, I was listening to transistor radio music and listening to the DJs, and I just loved that sound. And then I was just torn between being a disc jockey or the first woman on the Supreme Court. Sort of music and justice were always the two things that mattered to me. And I don't know, somehow the Kitchen Sisters, our stories are a lot about small communities and homeless people and people who've been incarcerated and people whose just stories you might not know. And I think that our stories sort of embody some of both, and they're just laden with music. You know, what is Plato said, he who controls rhythm controls. And I think we always sort of have that deep down in our soul about our stories. There's rhythm.
And there's kitchens too, and that's what's in your name. And that's the subject of one of the strands. You have several different strands, but it's all about secret, unexpected, below-the-radar cooking across America. Elaborate
on that. Not just
in
America, actually. We've been doing stories across America, but this last season that we did on NPR's Morning Edition was called Hidden Kitchens World. Well, we were listening to Frances McDormand, the Academy Award-winning actress, and she's the host of this. We just went around the world, and we're about to launch a new season of kitchen stories from everywhere. And that was, like she said, mafia kitchens from Sicily and turnspit dogs from England and atomic wine from France. And in Australia, the first Aboriginal cooking academy. And we say our microphone is a stethoscope, listening to the complicated heart of the world. And a lot of that beat comes from the kitchen.
And that sounds absolutely wonderful. Well, let's have an arterial gush of that, because you mentioned earlier the turnspit dogs. Now, we've got a tiny clip of that because it's absolutely intriguing, and I'm sure people join me in wanting to know more.
Turnspit dogs, they were viewed as kitchen utensils, as pieces of machinery. We have a huge fireplace in an old Georgian kitchen. There is a chain from the spit up to a wheel, and in that wheel is a small dog running frenetically, causing the spit to turn. The roar of the fire, the clanking of the spit, the patter from the little dog's feet. One way of training the dog was to throw a glowing coal into the wheel to make the dog speed up a bit.
That's a fantastic piece of radio. You can hear the fire. You can hear everything just happening there. As you said, it's a movie without actually seeing anything.
Yeah, that is our friend Ira Glass, who produces This American Life, says radio is the most visual medium. And I think if you do it right, it is.
Well, in fact, you have produced something visual because you've put out a book. Tell me about the Kitchen Sisters book.
It's called Hidden Kitchens, Stories, Recipes, and More from NPR's Kitchen Sisters. And it took the first season of our Hidden Kitchen series, and we brought the stories to life. We wrote them. There are a lot of visuals. There are recipes from all of them. And it was one thing we do with a lot of our radio series is we open up phone lines on our network, and we say to the nation, to the world, okay, we're searching for hidden kitchens. Tell us about yours. What's street corner cooking? Who are your local kitchen pioneers and visionaries? Who glues your community together through food? Thousands, 36 CDs full of messages, 2,789 minutes of messages came pouring in from all over the world, telling us about people's kitchen traditions. So that triggered a lot of the stories that you hear in our series and that are in that book as well.
Now, as you say, it's the rituals, the art, the history of people who've shaped not only America, but the world's diverse cultural heritage. Now, of course, one of the most defining things, particularly about America, were the events of 9/11. And you have catalogued that in sonic form.
Yes. Before we did the Hidden Kitchen series, we did a series called Lost and Found Sound. It was at the turn of the century, the millennium, and we decided to chronicle American life, 100 years of American life through recorded sound, to mark the turn of the century in sound. That's the first time we threw open the phone lines on NPR and asked the nation to tell us about vanishing voices, sound on the verge of extinction, endangered sound, important recordings that they had, especially because recording and the technology was in transition. The analog age was coming to an end. The digital age had been born, and all kinds of medium cylinders, you know, mini disc, you name it, was just in transition. And so we were just cataloging the sounds of life. And then 9/11 happened. So we'd been doing that for 2 years. Then 9/11 happened. And so we thought, okay, we know what this means, what the sound means. And so after the towers fell, we thought, you know, usually voicemail is not in the same building as the building itself. And probably all those phone messages, not just the last messages of those people as the buildings were falling, but weeks and weeks of the voices of people. We'd come to understand that the voice carried so much of the soul. And so we contacted Verizon, the company, and we asked them and worked with them. And we got all those voicemail messages back to people, the contents of people's voicemail boxes. So families had those voices. And then we started thinking, well, how do we chronicle, how do we memorialize this in sound? So we looked at 100 years of life in Lower Manhattan through recorded sound. We opened the phone lines again on public radio. Thousands and thousands of people called in. And out of that, we built this, was a series of stories and sort of a sonic shrine to that neighborhood to its life, to its passing, to its rebirth. And we called it the Sonic Memorial Project. It was a giant collaboration.
At this moment, we are gathering audio that relates, in some way, to the events of September 11th, before, during, and after. We're looking for audio artifacts, both personal and historic.
We came together over the last year. Radio producers, artists, construction workers, bond traders, secretaries, archivists, iron workers, policemen, widows, firefighters, public radio stations and listeners, to chronicle and commemorate the life and history of the World Trade Center and its neighborhood.
We appreciate your help in documenting this time, these places, and these people. Thanks.
Message 33 was received at...
Really, really profoundly moving piece of audio.
That's our colleague, the person doing the reach out and the message is one of the most extraordinary radio producers in America. His name is Jay Allison. I urge anyone who wants to make radio to go to his site, transom.org. All the things you need to create this craft are there. Jay was our partner on that. So Jay was the voice of the quest for sound. And the narrator was Paul Auster, wonderful writer Paul Auster, who sort of personifies New York. And Paul hosted that hour of stories that we all created together. And I urge people to hear that hour. The sonicmemorial.org is still up. You can hear all the stories and more.
And it won several awards, didn't it?
It did. It won, received the Peabody and many other awards. It was the first time a website was ever given a Peabody as well, because, again, we created this, not just radio, but this place for people to leave their sound and recordings. And it was very communal. It was very living, active. It was like a tree. It was like a tree that was being, I don't know, born.
Well, because building communities is really at the heart of what you do then, isn't it?
We've said that for years. The goal of our stories, the biggest goal, it sounds real ridiculous, but I would say is world peace. But in the meantime, it's building communities through storytelling. It's, you know, what do they say? An enemy is someone whose story you don't know. You know, in part, I think that's a lot why we're drawn to telling stories of food and music. You know, everybody eats. It's the common language. It's universal. And there are so many ways in which we're so divided. And so music and food are this way of realizing everyone, that olive tree, it means this to your culture and to your enemy's culture. You have more in common than you think.
Speaking of music and food, Groceries on My Shelf brings them together almost perfectly. You can tell you're a radio professional. You knew the song. We're heading now to this piece of music from Robert Shaw. Why have you chosen this?
We used this piece of music in the first Hidden Kitchen story, which was called An Unexpected Kitchen, the George Foreman Grill. And it was about how homeless people, someone called in and told us, homeless people and people in single room occupancies with no kitchen were cooking on sort of abandoned George Foreman grills on the streets, plugging into power poles. And this was how they were getting hot food. And we thought, oh my God, we had no idea. And did George Foreman, the former heavyweight champion boxer of the world, did he know it? Anyway, he didn't. And we wound up doing a story about that. And I was looking for Texas music because George Foreman's from the Fifth Ward in Texas, in Houston. And I started looking for Texas music. And all of a sudden came this song, My Name's Piggly Wiggly, I Got Groceries on My Shelf. And here was a story about hunger and the lack of food. And Robert Shaw is a barrel house piano player in the Santa Fe style of piano playing that followed the Santa Fe Railroad. And these guys would play this barrel house piano style up and down the rail lines. And then he retired and he had a barbecue joint outside of Austin. And the Piggly Wiggly was the first grocery store in America where you didn't have to ask a clerk to take things down from the shelf. You could just go through with your own cart or basket and pull them off. So when he says, my name's Piggly Wiggly, I got groceries on my shelf, it just all fit.
Piggly Wiggly, I've got groceries on my shelf. My name Piggly Wiggly, I've got groceries on my shelf. Getting tired, making these nights all by myself. My mama told me, Papa told me too. My mama told me, Papa told me too. Don't let these Cadillac women make no flat tire out of me.
Groceries on My Shelf, that comes from Robert Shaw. Great piece of music, that.
Isn't that phenomenal? And that, my friends, is on the Arhuli label. I don't know how many of you know that label. It's over 50 years old. Chris Strachwitz in Berkeley, El Cerrito, California, has just gone into Texas and Louisiana and throughout the world finding just the soul music and bringing it to record. Mance Lipscomb, Zydeco, you name it. And anyway, that's where I found that piece of music from Arhuli Records.
Fantastic.
The record is called, the album's called The Maw Grinder. The maw is part of the chitlins.
And chitlins is a thing you eat, isn't it?
Yes.
Excuse
yes,
my,
you do.
My foreign ignorance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the innards.
I want to talk now about The Hidden World of Girls. That's a series that you did that explores the lives of girls and women and the women that they become. Tell me the premise for that.
We started looking for stories of coming of age, rituals and rites of passage, secret identities, women who crossed a line, blazed a trail, changed the tide. You know, we call ourselves the Kitchen Sisters, and everyone always assumed we were a food show or a women's show. And Nikki and I have been telling radio stories together for almost 30 years. And it wasn't until 25 years in that we started the Kitchen Stories. And then after that, we started the Girls' Stories. It just, you know, again, that idea of stories from the B side of history, little known aspects, but always having some kind of spark, something unusual, people possessed by a vision or something. And so we just wanted to look into the lives of women and girls. And sort of the point of departure of that series was to think about beauty and images, women's self-image. And I was sitting in a beauty shop one day, which is where we find a lot of our stories, in nail salons and beauty shops and backs of taxi cabs. And anyway, someone started talking to me about chicken pills, about how women in Jamaica, the skinny body, the, you know, minimal body that is so valorized in the Western world, was not the prized body. The prized body was big breasts, big butt. And women, in order to achieve that, were taking the pills that were being fed to the chickens to give them big thighs and big breasts, you know, those, that kind of plumped up chicken that you buy, hormonized chicken. And I just went, can that be true? And they said, well, not only that, but the women were buying so many chicken pills that they had to pass a law in Jamaica that, because there were no chicken pills for the farmers who wanted to feed their chicken the pills, so they said you had to have a chicken in order to get the pill. So all these women in Jamaica started keeping chickens, or so I was told. So I said, well, I think I have to go to Jamaica and get into finding out about this.
And you did. Here it is.
Carol Turpin, St. Catherine, Jamaica. Chicken pills. Some girls, to be more attractive to the male, they get themselves into this use of chicken pills.
I've been hearing about chicken pills since being in elementary in the 90s. My name is Jason Turpin. I'm a college student from Kingston in Jamaica. Chicken pills are the same pills that you give to the chicken to make them grow faster. You use chicken pills if you want to get broader hips or bigger bottom. In our Jamaican culture, you know, we love a girl that has a shape.
Most males, they love to see women with big bottoms.
I mean, I find that profoundly disturbing, but I guess that in parts of Jamaica, it's entirely normal.
I mean, the body, I think women coming from Africa and how bodies are born, how bodies are shaped by history, bigger bodies are the body. And I think those are also in history, the body's probably more likely to survive. And someone goes on in that story to say, if you're sitting on a big bottom, you're sitting on a lot of power.
Which to me is one of the favorite lines we've ever recorded. But like in the U.S., I mean, it's so disturbing to watch women starving themselves and making themselves throw up to lose weight. Every culture's got some level of distortion. You know, there's a body type that is prized, and then people go to lengths. What's amazing about Jamaica, what I had such respect for and love for in Jamaica, was how public the discourse. I mean, if you go to the dance halls, if you listen to the music, chicken pills are throughout the music. Chicken pills are, people are talking about women and their bodies and their size and their what they're taking. And, you know, in America, it's sort of swept. It's sort of this, oh, don't talk about it until it's scandal, scandal, scandal. It's very upfront. There's huge consequences to chicken pills. I mean, there's real health risks, and there are big, and skin bleaching too is the other piece of that in Jamaican culture, the lightening of skin and all the consequences of that in the sort of bootleg market. If you go down into the main market, there's this just really underground black market bleaching chicken pill scene. That's Jamaica's version. Every culture's got its chicken pill.
Mm. What other coming of age stories have you come across during that strand?
We went to, there's a tribe, the Dakota Sioux tribe in South Dakota, and the coming of age rituals for the girls had disappeared over the years. And the Braveheart Women's Society, which had been a society in the 1800s and times when the tribes was being decimated, and they would take the dead from the battlefield and they would do the rituals for the dead and they would do the coming of age rituals for girls. These elders of this tribe started to reinstate these coming of age rituals for girls, which are a 5-day ritual. They're taken from the tribe. They have to build their own teepees, learn how to do that. They are with their mothers or their aunts or the grandmothers, whatever woman is in their life. And for 5 days, the girls cannot feed themselves. They are literally fed by the women. Sort of they return to a baby state, and, you know, their ritualized baby state. They are sewn new dresses by the elders of the tribe. They are taught to go into the hills and into the woods and learn all the medicinal plants. They are left alone. It's sort of that kind of passage. And then at the end, there is this ritual where they are all honored by the tribe of coming out as women. So we chronicled that as well. There was one story, I don't know if people know Chris Abani, beautiful Nigerian writer. He told the story of his mother was a white woman from England, his father from Nigeria. They met, moved back to Nigeria together, and then had all these children. And she started working on birth control issues in the little village in Nigeria where they were. And he, as an 8-year-old boy, because she knew as a white woman, not of the tribes, she could not speak to these women about birth control, and she didn't know the language well enough to do it, but she just knew she was crossing the line. So she brought her 8-year-old son with her, and he had to, without knowing the meaning of any of these things, she taught him to ask them about their period because she was trying to teach them about their cycles. And so there she is explaining to her 8-year-old son, you need to say to them where they are in the month. And he was so rattled and ashamed and embarrassed by this. So he would say, is it a brook? Is it a river? Or is it a waterfall? This was this young, so I have this image of this young boy going door to door in a
extraordinary
village.
I mean, access is all, isn't it? And it seems that you have got extraordinary access to the most intimate parts of people's lives.
I think people want and need to tell their stories. And I think we're sort of all put here to bear witness. And our microphone is sort of the divining rod. It's the catcher of that. It's just there. And, you know, at first, a lot of people defer or say, no, well, my story's not important. But just if you stay put or just show up, I think most people could have the access we have.
Mm. Now, you live in San Francisco, and one of the programs that you make is called The Making Of, and it is all about what people make in the Bay Area. Let's listen to a little snippet from it.
You have 87 new messages.
We make hand-built chicken coops in Petaluma, California. I've built probably about 30,000 surfboards.
Our group have been working to make the first built from the ground up co-housing community in Silicon Valley, where we could have an old-fashioned neighborhood.
The making of the Bay Bridge, the making of a jar of jam, the making of the iPhone, an opera, a surfboard.
What a fun series to be involved with. You must have met a hugely diverse amount of people for that.
Oh, my God. I mean, my favorite one was the making of the Homobile, which we said was a story of transportation, civil rights, and glitter. And it's sort of Uber for drag queens in San Francisco, because drag queens and gay people and a lot of sex workers weren't getting picked up by taxi cabs, or if they were, they were getting harassed. So this whole community ride service has started, called the Homobile. It's Mo's getting hose where they needs to goes.
Oh, that sounds absolutely fabulous. Now, you live, and as I said, in San Francisco, you work there too, but radio is not the only thing that you do.
I have been a casting director for years. I haven't been doing as much of it of late because I sort of fell back into my possession by radio. And we're working on a Broadway musical, actually, based on one of our radio stories. So I'm involved with that right now. And I worked a lot with Francis Coppola for years and years doing casting. And then I wrote a script that got made into a Harvey Keitel movie. So
tell us about it. Don't just brush off the Harvey Keitel movie.
He has the best feet. Harvey Keitel works barefoot a lot, or back when I worked with him, he did. Here are the two secrets I learned from Harvey Keitel. He's got great feet, worked barefoot a lot. And then also, anywhere he goes, he keeps a pound of coffee in his car. And so the car always smells like coffee, especially when the sun hits the back window. So it was a little tip, just sort of nice way to scent your car.
That's a fabulous story. So your script got made, but you also, as you said, worked with Francis Ford Coppola. I can never say that. Yeah, I want to say Coppola. I want to anglicize it, but that would be wrong. What movies did you work on with him?
I started on Peggy Sue Got Married, then Tucker and Gardens of Stone, and helped some with Dracula, and helped some with Godfather 3. But really interesting thing about Francis is he loves radio, deeply loves radio, which is why our offices are in Francis Coppola's building, and in part because he's so supportive of radio. And oftentimes for his scripts, as he's developing them, he does radio versions of them. You know, we take the stage direction and we have a narrator who's reading all that in that old-fashioned 1940s radio drama way. And then we perform it in small theaters with series of mics on a stage and everyone, you know, reading their part. And so he's really fun to work with. The man's extremely creative.
As are you. Let's take your next piece of music. Now, this is Los Lobos. It's Kiko and the Lavender Moon. Tell me why you chose this.
Back to the idea of he who controls or she who controls, rhythm controls, we use a lot of music in our stories. And something about this song in particular, but Los Lobos, we do a lot of stories of Mexico and Mexican culture. We just did one called the Tequila Chamber of Commerce. We did a story about the Chili Queens of San Antonio. And somehow Los Lobos music, and also what Los Lobos stand for. I mean, I feel like the Kitchen Sisters, I mean, we just revere Los Lobos, and Los Lobos are the Kitchen Sisters of rock and roll. They are the ultimate garage band. They care about culture so deeply. And one minute they're just rocking, and the next minute they're into the corrido tradition of Mexico. They are just nothing but the truth.
Dance and dance, still dance until he goes off to sleep.
I'm here in the studio with my fabulous guest, who is Davia Nelson. She's from the Kitchen Sisters, one half of the Kitchen Sisters, who make amazing audio for broadcast on many different stations around the world. It's kind of global radio, isn't it? And that piece of music that we just heard, Los Lobos, Kiko and the Lavender Moon, you were talking to me about how you manipulate music for your own ends.
Oh, yes, our own dastardly ends. With a lot of music that's got lyrics, because it's so hard to hear someone tell a story on top of lyrics in a song. So we might take take the beginning of that instrumental and then cut to the instrumental section in the middle of a song and then take to the end of it and graft all those pieces together and create a bed, a sort of sonic riverbed of music that our teller is telling over. And, you know, sometimes when we're doing it, you just want the beginnings and then you fade it out. And sometimes it's so beautiful as punctuation to hit that end of a song and have it come to a close, a full stop, and then a new story begins.
Now, tell me about your new stories. What's next for you and what are you doing at the moment?
We're kind of working on a story about kimchi diplomacy. We're kind of thinking about Korea at the moment and the kind of role of Korea has actually a policy to open restaurants around the world to try and present Korean culture. So we're sort of looking into that. We're working on a story right now called The Apple Road, about these Russian women who have actually been coming here to London, to Britain, and they have been restoring all kinds of apple cultures and all kinds of just economic towns that have fallen into complete disrepair in the Soviet Union, trying to revive these cultures and life through these lost apples. We are working on a story called The Manifesto of Seed. We're working on a story called The Egg Wars, about the gold miners in California when there was no eggs there. You know, all this people come in the 1800s, 1840s to the Bay Area, and there's no eggs. And so they wind up going to these shorebirds 27 miles off the islands and stealing the eggs from MERS. And so we're telling the story of the egg war. Someone died for eggs.
How extraordinary. Combine that with the chicken pills and everything would even out, wouldn't they? Too many chickens and not enough eggs. Davia, we're almost out of time. Just quickly, I know that you do a whole education program and you're really encouraging people to get involved with radio. You train voices and you make sure people know that actually it's really accessible medium.
It's one of the most accessible. I'll say again, transom.org is one of the great places. Radiodiaries.org, kitchensisters.org. There's a lot of training. And we move around the world doing the Kitchen Sisters interviewing and training workshop because these tools are very simple, very accessible, very affordable. There's many levels you can start at. And, you know, the digital world, it's easy to edit at this point. And we just believe in the deep value of gathering stories, gathering voices, hearing perspectives that are unknown. And there's a lot of power in storytelling.
That was Davia Nelson of the Kitchen Sisters. Next, I caught up with the novelist Niven Govinden about his novel All the Days and Nights.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Niven Govinden, who has been writing like mad since the last time we met. Niven was one of the first people that I interviewed for Monocle 24, and he's back having achieved great success, not only with the last book that he was here to talk about, which was Black Bread, White Beer, but he's got a brand new one out. It's called All the Days and Nights. I'm thrilled that he's here to talk about it because since we last met, he's become this huge literary star. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Niven, let's just recap your career because I know you've been writing since your late teens. You went to Goldsmiths College,
yes.
But then you worked in the music business for a while.
Yeah, well, for about over 10 years, it was, you know, that's my proper day job. And I was writing all through that time, but I think it's important to kind of do other things and see the world and not just live in your head all the time.
And the music business work, I mean, in the end, I think it was the egos of the pop stars that got to you.
Actually, in a lot of ways, less to do with the egos of the artist, but more to do with the egos of the people around you. The music business is all about ego. it's a great ride, but you know, this is obviously what I want to be doing. So,
and as you said, you were writing all the way through it, but
yes,
quite often sort of going off to clubs and really kind of getting into the zeitgeist of the times and then going home to put it all down on paper.
Yeah, I mean, my first novel wasn't really about music, but it tapped into a certain kind of energy that London had. And when I was writing in my teens and, you know, going to gigs and going to clubs as a 17, 18-year-old, that was kind of what I was interested in. I knew that in terms of what I wanted to write, there was a kind of wider range I wanted to work from, but at the time there was just a really great energy that no one was really sort of exploring in art, so.
Lana, that came out in the book, We Are the New Romantics.
Yes.
Just talk us through that book.
When I started it, I knew I definitely didn't want to do a book about London because a lot of people were writing books about London at that time in that sort of cool Britannia thing, but I wanted to tap into that energy. And in a lot of ways, it felt like a sort of reimagining of Fitzgerald's Tender is the Night. So you've got these two kind of really cool kids from London who want to do a kind of mini grand tour on their own terms around Europe. And it explores a very kind of narcissistic, destructive relationship.
And absolutely got the spirit of the times. And London seemed to be a very different time at that point. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm not sure whether it's just because we're older. I think when you're sort of, you know, between sort of 17 and 25, everything is new and exciting and then there is a dynamic. I think the cultural energy has shifted in a lot of ways. And also this is a pre-digital age, so I think there was a greater kind of innocence in a lot of ways.
Then you did, of course, the really big thing, which is, and looking at the stats where we see that full-time authors, the average earning is about £11,000 a year. You did that big thing of giving up safety and saying, fine, I am actually a writer and that's what I'm going to do. That must have taken tremendous courage.
I think I've got to that point where, you know, you either have to do it or you don't. And I was just at the point where I was halfway through writing my second book and I was still working full time. And I did sort of feel that something had to give. And I think everyone, at whatever stage of life, everyone has a moment where they want to fly by the seat of their pants if they can. And that was kind of my moment. Mm.
Tell me about Graffiti My Soul. That was the book you were writing at the time.
It's a book about a group of teenagers. And it's like a love letter to the suburbs. I suppose a comparative is something like The Virgin Suicides, though at the time I wasn't really thinking about that book, but I wanted to write something that was very much kind of an homage to the sort of manicured beauty and frustration and the kind of underscore of violence of being in a home county suburb.
And of course, that's where you come from.
Yes.
a lot of underscored violence there?
I think all those places, I think when you're very young, I think as a teenager, I think you just get really frustrated by the limitations of whether it's your environment or what you want to be doing or just being held back, all those kind of things, not having found your own voice or having your voice and not knowing how to use it, all those things. So I think the book was definitely kind of an exploration of that. But I have to say it was kind of in no way autobiographical. I'm very much influenced by or really concerned with sort of setting you know, the notion of place in a book and really celebrating the notion of place almost to the point that it feels like it's a character in the book, that it really is, it really feels resonant and incredibly real. And I think that comes across through pretty much all my work.
I would like to move on now to your very latest book,
okay,
which is called All the Days and Nights. Now, the title is actually a quote from Frida Kahlo. It's, I leave you my portrait so that you will have my presence all the days and nights that I am away from you.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful, beautiful quote. Tell me the premise. We talked about an artist. And
I suppose in a nutshell, it's the story of an artist and her muse, or two muses, but essentially one muse. And it's an American portrait painter. And she's pretty old. She's sort of early 80s. And she's working on what will probably be her final portrait. The book opens when her muse, which you learn to be her husband, who she's painted pretty much every day for 50 years, has disappeared. So she knows she's working on her last painting and she's telling the story of her kind of creative life as a painter. But also she narrates the whole thing. She's also narrates what happens to her husband, John Brown, when he leaves her. And basically he is, while she's painting her last portrait, she knows she's dying. She knows this is going to be her last work. He is traveling around America looking at all the paintings, all the key paintings for him, that she has painted of him, because he's trying to work out whether it was worth it, whether his life had any meaning.
And I think the reason I'm finding it difficult to articulate what it means is that initially your sympathy is entirely with her. You think this poor woman, she's dying, she's this very talented painter. Yeah. But actually, as you read the book, that's not really how it pans out.
Well, I mean, I don't think she's entirely unsympathetic, but what I wanted to do, you know, one of my key things was I really wanted to write, you know, if you're going to write about art, you need to write about the rigour of creating art. And that kind of really takes front stage in the book for me, which is, you know, this is a woman who is, you know, also she's a successful painter. And the book's set in 1980, so it's right, it's sort of the twilight era of that kind of, the twilight era of really the American century of portrait painting, because, you know, the 80s gives you the superstars, the auction room figures, you know, Basquiat, Warhol, Haring, Koons. So, you know, she's really sort of the last of her kind. You know, she's the sort of last woman who would have a painting that would be in an exhibition that people would talk about in the New York Times and be offended by. It wouldn't really happen after that. So to be that kind of successful takes a certain amount of rigour and selfishness. She's not part of an art scene. You know, they live in a house, you know, up in the country somewhere. They shut themselves, she shuts herself away just to do her work. She wants to get up, she wants to work. The people around her need to work, be part of the work. And sometimes they do it willingly and sometimes they don't, but they're all committed to the process. Mm. And that's, you know, that's very interesting. You know, I was always really fascinated by the relationships between portrait painters and sitters. When you think of, you know, specifically, I think more recently, Lucian Freud and David Dawson, I'm really interested in that relationship. You know, he was Lucian's assistant, but he was also painted by him. What happens in the room when he's painting him? You know, they talk, there's an alchemy. I'm not necessarily looking to be forensic about it. There's a certain kind of mysticism that I'm interested in.
Mm. He comes across, her husband, John, comes across slightly as her victim, though.
No, I disagree. I think, no, because he wants to be there. It's a willing process.
But is he damaged by it?
I think half the point of the search is for him to realise, you know, if it's been worthwhile. And, you know, the book really talks about, you know, in the same way we talk about, you know, a book existing after you've read it and beyond being an object. The same thing with painting. You know, you look at a painting and you get something from it, you know, it speaks to you, you know, but you don't necessarily know how it came about. And you don't need to know that story in a lot. You know, it's really not important. I think when you look at it, that's not the point of what painting is, particularly for portraits.
Now, the book obviously looks at the relationship between the two of them, not only as muse and painter, but also as husband and wife. And that's something, of course, as we were talking earlier, we've seen in your previous books.
Sure.
So this examination of relationships, of marriage, is something, obviously, that you're very interested in.
Yeah, in a different way, though. I think this relationship is far more mysterious. I don't think you can necessarily define it in a way. I mean, they don't even define themselves as husband and wife. They're just kind of there. There are similarities in terms of, you know, they're very kind of compressed environments. But in terms of that relationship, that kind of idea that it's a marriage is more of a, it's more of a social contract than it is in terms of what we would think as marriage, especially in terms of the last book.
Mm. Finally, I want to talk about loss, because we know that her death is approaching. She knows that.
Sure.
It's all there. And so it's about learning to deal with loss before it's actually happened.
Yeah, and I think especially in terms of, you know, if you're doing creative work, it's that notion of preparing, and it's that whole thing of legacy. What's going to happen to this work after I've gone? What will you think of it? How will you deal with it? And, you know, the book talks about it as well. It's the luxury of being able to do that, in terms of she's working and she knows this will be her last painting, but she knows it's a luxury that she can actually choose to do one last thing. So that's kind of, yeah, that's a good notion to explore.
It's incredibly poignant and a very haunting novel. It's called All the Days and Nights. It's by Niven Govinden, and it's out now. Niven, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Hector MacDonald is a best-selling author and a publishing entrepreneur. He was born and brought up in Africa. He has a degree in zoology, and now he's just launched a fascinating new website. He's the author of now 4 thrillers, but the fourth one is where the story really is, because it's a whole new way of publishing. Hector, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start off with your writing career, because you wrote 3 thrillers published by Penguin.
That's right, yes. I started with a book called The Mind Game, which made quite a splash about the turn of the millennium, which gave me very high expectations of what publishing would deliver for the rest of my life. But it's been a great time, actually, writing books. I've always loved reading thrillers. I grew up, as you said, in Africa, where there was no TV in my house, at least, and thrillers filled in for all the other forms of entertainment that were missing.
It's a very clear genre, isn't it? But within that genre, there are many different shades of grey, if you like. I mean, you go really from the Le Carré to the Fleming. Whereabouts are you within that?
That's right. Well, I've actually tried to strike a sort of middle course between those two, which may be a disastrous strategy, it may be a complete failure, but I've tried to balance the glamour of Fleming and in the movies of Bourne with the grey authenticity, the grittiness and true kind of intelligence officer sort of betrayals and intrigue of John le Carré and various other writers who have tried to go for that much more authentic feel.
Now, you've got a wonderful website, and we're going to talk about the new things that you're doing within publishing and being digital in a moment. But one of the things that you host on the website is some tutorials about how to write a spy thriller. So how do you do it?
Well, first off, you have to ask yourself what a spy thriller is. And I spent quite a lot of time trying to puzzle this one out. It's not just about gadgets. It's not about guns. It's not about fast cars and pretty girls and casinos. It's about some very simple concepts. And one of them is the search for a secret, because intelligence is all about trying to find out what the other guys don't want you to know. So uncovering secrets is a major part of it. Deception is a big part of it. And paranoia, betrayal, these kinds of ideas are important elements too. So I started the whole series by really trying to set out in a video, you know, what it is that you need to be considering if you want to build a spy novel.
Now, people often talk about writing what you know, but obviously some of the things you're writing about are highly secret. How do you get that knowledge?
They're not that secret anymore. Various whistleblowers have done us a big favour in the espionage writing community. So Edward Snowden and co have made it clear. And I think what they've made clear is that the reality is actually very, very boring in a lot of cases. So most of it now is done through electronic eavesdropping, guys in front of computer screens in a sort of basement somewhere in the States. And that obviously isn't going to make for a very interesting thriller. So you have to maintain a certain element of the sort of fictional glamorous world as well. But I've tried to kind of get a good combination of the two.
And readers are obviously very engaged with this. As you say, your very first novel, a huge bestseller.
Well, yes, it was a surprise to a lot of us, I think. And it was a very simple book that was set in Kenya and Oxford. And it was about a science experiment that made rather unethical use of a poor undergraduate as this guinea pig. And it just seemed to hit a chord with a lot of people. I've tried to kind of capture that magic again since, with not much success, but it's very difficult to kind of capture that X factor that you see in things like White Teeth or, you know, The Beach or these other books or High Fidelity that made a huge, huge impact on people.
You have a blog which is called Shaping Reality, and it's about there being more than one truth. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of my work is working with businesses as a communications consultant, and it's very interesting that you can portray all kinds of different forms of the truth for those businesses. And you see this all the time in the media, and politicians are doing this all the time too. And they call it creating the story or crafting the narrative. And it seemed to me that it was important that this was studied. So I've written this blog, Shaping Reality, to try and set out some of the ways in which different truths can be presented. For example, around the First World War, there were a lot of different ways of presenting the anniversary of its start this year. Some people who wanted to paint it as a, you know, glorious sort of patriotic fight for right against the forces of imperialism, whereas others who saw this as, you know, the most terrible thing that ever happened to humanity and should be painted as a dreadful, dreadful act of atrocities.
One of the subjects you also explore is IS and how we view them, that terrorism is perhaps the wrong word when looked at in an historical context.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, that's becoming apparent as we take military action against IS, that, you know, the portrayal of them as just a bunch of terrorists is really unhelpful. We need to see them as a significant army, a marauding army. They may not actually have a state despite their name, but you can see them as akin to the Huns or, you know, the Mongols racing across Europe and destroying all in their wake. This is not simply a terrorist organization. Mm. And in the same piece, I explored the idea of nation states, that, you know, we think of the world divided into nation states and terrorist groups. And actually, if you look at the nation states in the Middle East, many of them fail the first rule, of the first of definition of a nation state, which is the ability to maintain sovereign control over your entire territory and your population. And of course, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, you know, all these countries have failed that test immediately.
And you have very interesting points to make about Victorian Britain.
Well, yes. I mean, so we look at the atrocities taking place in the Middle East, and people are rightly horrified by what IS has been doing in terms of crucifixions and beheadings and so on. But it's only 100 years ago that European powers were doing exactly the same thing. Belgian freebooters, enterprises in the Congo cutting off people's hands on a routine basis. The British in India punishing mutineers by strapping them over the muzzle of a cannon and firing them into oblivion. We've all been guilty of horrendous atrocities in the name of making a statement, making a point. And that's just what IS is doing now. It's not to excuse them, but we need to understand that these things, you know, have gone on throughout history. And just because we're in a period now of great civilization on, you know, on our side, we hope, we like to think that, we shouldn't be, you know, so astonished by what's going on in other parts of the world.
So perhaps the way to stop IS and what's going on is to learn the lessons of the past and to look back at how terrible things like, for instance, slavery or the other ills of colonialism were stopped. It's through education, really.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a cliche to say that, you know, if you don't understand your history, then you're destined to repeat it. And it's crucial that we understand the larger context. I think it also, you know, can give us some hope in the sense that there has been a progression, as you say, from slavery and some other horrendous atrocities and horror stories from the past, which we have to some extent grown out of. So I think there's hope for everyone. We shouldn't sort of look at what's happening in the Middle East, this apparent sort of downward trajectory of chaos and despair as a sort of ongoing process that we can't reverse.
So that's explored more in your blog, which is called Shaping Reality, More Than One Truth. But there's a lot more that you have to offer on the internet. You have, as I was saying, How to Write a Spy Thriller. You have your blog, but you've just launched a whole new digital platform, I suppose you would call it.
Yes, it's really it's a publishing imprint. It's a publishing company. And it's like any other traditional publishing company. We select good books. We edit them really well with professional structural editors, copy editors, proofing and so on. And we design good covers and shape them really beautifully. And then we do one extra thing that no other publisher does at the moment, which is we invite the rest of the world to have their say before the book goes into its final publication. So we put out an ebook as a sort of beta edition, if you like, and invite the rest of the world to spend 3 months looking through it and coming up with suggestions for how the author can make any final changes, any final improvements. Maybe they can spot some errors. Maybe they can come up with some bright ideas about extra things that the author might do. And after 3 months, the author has the choice of choosing between those whichever comments they want to take on board and make final revisions, and then we publish it in a normal way.
I think it sounds absolutely fabulous. I mean, it encompasses everything from character, you can make suggestions about characters, to, as you say, fact-checking that perhaps things were not absolutely correct there and people can put authors right.
That's absolutely right. So, you know, there are many, many errors to be found in great books throughout history, and, you know, from Dickens through Austin right up to J.K. Rowling these days.
Give me some of those famous literary howlers, because I know that you have a great list of them. I mean, it goes right back to Julius Caesar, doesn't it? William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar.
Absolutely. Well, famously, there's a clock that strikes in Julius Caesar. I think that's about 1,000 years before striking clocks were actually invented. So it's just a nice anachronism, but no harm done.
And then, of course, there's the King James Bible, which tells us that we should commit adultery.
I know, isn't that a wonderful misprint? Robinson Crusoe swimming out to a shipwreck naked and then filling his pockets with all the bounty he found there. There's Charles Dickens uses chloroform in A Tale of Two Cities sometime before it was actually used as a whatever that drug is.
An anaesthetic.
Thank you. There we go.
And we were talking about Ian Fleming earlier and James Bond. There's a good one in Casino Royale.
Well, it's interesting, Ian Fleming, because, of course, having written a spy novel myself, I'm very interested in this one. He had a famous incident where he equipped James Bond in the first few books with a Beretta, which he saw as just the right kind of weapon for his secret agent. But he got a letter from an armourer some books in saying, "I'm very much enjoying the tales of Commander Bond, but why have you given him a lady's gun?" And not a very nice lady at that. He should, if he needs to stop a Smersh agent at 20 paces, be equipped with something more like a Walther PPK. And so Fleming, of course, because he was writing a series, he was able to build that into the next book. And so Bond's famous gun now is a Walther PPK. But Karen. But for most authors, that's not an option, of course. We write our books and then it's all over. So what we're trying to do with advanced editions is to give authors that chance to have an interaction with the public. And it's a very, very wide public now, of course, because it stretches worldwide and we're connected through social media and other digital channels to just about everyone on the planet now. We're hoping that we can bring that kind of expertise, that sort of crowd wisdom, to the service of authors for a limited period before their books are published.
How does it work as a business model?
As a traditional publishing house, so we have exactly the same structure as any other publishing imprint. We don't have quite so many overheads, but essentially we sell books. That's how we make money. The only difference is that we put them out for a period before we actually sell the final version.
So it's like a great big global book club.
I hope so, yes. I mean, we're depending on how many people we can persuade to come and join our community. Advanced editions could be, you know, the next Goodreads, but with a more concrete purpose, if you like, rather than just reviewing books. And there's a huge amount of energy already out there on the web to review books. This is a chance for readers to actually have some input into a book, to make a contribution and make a, you know, already good book better.
And people will feel very, very invested in it. So then they'll want to have the final book, won't they?
And give it to 10 of their friends is my hope. But, you know, we have to see. I mean, my hope certainly is that that when someone has made a significant contribution to an author's book and sees that author takes an interest and is grateful for that intervention and makes use of it, that they will, you know, be really a fan of that author for a while, because it should be a really, you know, a good experience for both reader and writer to have that kind of direct interaction, which is sorely lacking in publishing at the moment.
That was the wonderful Hector MacDonald. He's an author of great spy novels and an entrepreneur and a visionary publisher with the advanced editions, a whole new way of making good books better. Well, that's all we've got time for on this episode of the Saturday Selection, where we've given you some highlights from Monocle 24's weekend edition. This episode was produced and mixed by Claire Urban, research by James Bullock, and I'm Georgina Godwin. Join us again to hear some of the very best of the weekend's interviews here on Monocle 24. And of course, you can always catch us live every Saturday. If you'd like to drop us a line, please email gg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.